Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
Reports of the death of our relationship have been greatly exaggerated.
It's episode 38 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is the same as last week's guest. It's David Walsh, the chief sports writer of the Sunday Times. We played part one of our interview last week, so if you missed it, just scroll down and you'll find it on your podcast feed. In this concluding part of the interview, there is a little bit more chat about Lance and then a whole lot more talk about Team Sky as David reflects on his coverage of the team, which was heavily criticised, and there was no more high-profile criticism of that coverage than that which came from his friend Paul Kimmage, which ended with Paul saying on News Talk Radio that their relationship was dead. We talk about where that relationship stands today, and we cover lots of other ground, including whether rugby and soccer has the kind of doping problem that is endemic in other sports. We also throw a couple of your questions to David, so if you do want to submit questions and topics for future guests, just join the members' WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. You can also get in touch with us by emailing behindthelines@the42.ie, or you can tweet me. I'm at gcooney93. That is enough from me. Let's get on with the concluding part of our interview with David Walsh. I do want to pick up on something that you said earlier, actually, is the fact that you listen to Lance Armstrong's podcast. I'm amazed by that. I can't think of anyone I'd want in my ears less than Lance Armstrong.
Well, you know, he's quite a charismatic character. And, you know, he can be very funny. There are occasions when he can be very insightful. He can say something about the race and see something that happens in a race in a way that nobody else sees it. And then he will also say something that indicates he hasn't done his homework. And he's not like proper journalist. He can be a bit hazy on the facts. But I do like his kind of style. I mean, the guy is charismatic. I used to always think, you know, if I walked into a room and Armstrong is the subject for discussion, yeah, people will be interested maybe in what my take on this is. But if Armstrong ever walked into the room 15 minutes later, anybody who was half interested in talking to me would immediately zoom over to Armstrong, because he does have that charisma. He does have that presence. He does have that aura. And I think he still has it. And that's why I think if he was able to help himself, and he's not, he would have got right back into favor. I mean, imagine when Marina Zenovich in this ESPN documentary gives him like bog standard question about your son, Lance, Luke. He's now a freshman in university. He's a good football player. He comes home to you and he says that the coach tells him he should take anabolic steroids. What do you say to him? And Lance says, I say, Luke, you're just a freshman. It's only college football. Don't go there. But if it was the NFL, that would be a different conversation, Lance said. And everybody listening to that is saying, so after what you've been through, you would advise this guy to take drugs? Jesus. You know, it's like, how could you? And Lance, you know, what were you thinking? Just daft. I mean, if there's one message from Lance Armstrong's life, it is that doping gets you in trouble. And that's before you begin to wonder about the long-term impact on your health. I mean, we spoke about Yulia Stepanova. I mean, she used a lot of EPO. And I'm not good on the science and the medical science of it. But when you create extra red cells, you need extra iron to make sure that the level of iron is commensurate with your level of red cells. I think that's the theory. You certainly need extra iron supplementation. So she took a lot of iron supplementation. And what that created in her system was excess iron. Now she doesn't take EPO. She doesn't need the excess iron. But her body is producing excess iron because that's what it got used to doing during the EPO years. And she can avoid health problems at the moment by having a pretty vigorous running regime every day where she basically burns off the excess iron. once she stops exercising intensely, she's got a medical problem that will need to be treated with serious medication. Now, how many Yulia Stepanova-like problems are there out there? How many other people have issues related to their doping that they would never tell you about? My guess is plenty.
I've one last question about Lance. From your point of view, like you kind of said it earlier on, you were kind of obsessed with him for a while and it was such a big story and you were so central to it. When it's over, you've written the book, you've been portrayed in the movie, you've done the documentaries. Is it hard to move on from a story that big?
Well, I kind of thought it was, but people do kind of ask you about it.
Yeah, so maybe I'm not letting you move on here.
Yeah, and like, you know, I mean, it's people are trying to be really considerate and they're trying to be nice. I mean, I at my local golf club here in Newmarket, I was out playing and I put my name down against the guy, you know, it's all timesheet now since lockdown, we have to put our names down. And I put my name down against a guy that I'd never met. I like doing that. I like playing with strangers. Because it's like kind of looking for diamonds in a river, you know? You don't know when you're going to pull up something that gleams. And this guy was standing there. And I hope he doesn't listen to this. And but I say his name was Baron. His first name is Baron. Right. And I saw him outside the club. I was just standing there. And I said, "Are you Baron?" He said, "I am." And I said, "I'm David." He said, "Don't worry. I know who you are. I've read all your books. I've seen the movies. I've seen..." And in the nicest possible way, right, he wants to ask every question under the rising sun. And I'll tell you, and he's a lovely, absolutely smashing guy. I've spoken to him since, and he's as good a guy as you'll ever meet. But I'll tell you, by about the fourth hole, I was up to here with Lance, and there are occasions, you know, that... But people mean well, and people, it still intrigues people because it was a one-off story, and it's not like people heard about it and then they see me and oh, I was interested in that years ago, but I'm not interested now. The amount of people who've said to me, you know, "I hated you in those years because I believed in Lance and you were the devil incarnate for questioning him. And you were my nemesis. I just hated what you were doing." And then I realized, of course, you know, Lance was the chief and I changed my view. But they want to talk and they want to almost say sorry, all these, even though you never knew them. So I meet a lot of that, but I'm cool about that. Oscar Wilde, you know, only one thing worse than people talking about you. And that's people not talking about you.
We'll go on to pick number three is Paul Kimmage's book, Engage, which he did with Matt Hampson. This book is a staple of most best sports books lists that I shamefully haven't opened yet. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you picked it?
Well, it should be a tragic story. This is a story about a young rugby player who gets paralyzed from the neck down and is forced to live, you know, a very difficult life subsequent to that accident when he was training with the England under 20s. And the book is exactly the opposite. It's incredibly uplifting and it's told in the most incredible way. I mean, really unusual. Paul's kind of sense of what of narrative is just, it's like, it's doesn't recognize any rules. He just told it the way he felt it should be told and it worked completely. The reason, I mean, you could mention Tony Cascarino's book that Paul did in exactly the same light, another brilliant, brilliant book, Rough Ride, a brilliant book. But what I remember about, the reason I put down Engage is that I was interviewing somebody in Plymouth. I can't remember from Adam who I was interviewing. And I just got Engage to bring with me. And I went into a coffee shop at about 1 o'clock, interview done. And I said, "Look, I can read it for 2 hours and then I can still beat the M25 by getting to the M25 about 3:30 and getting on towards Newmarket." Well, I lived outside Cambridge at that point, getting off the M25 by about 5:00. And I started reading at 1 o'clock and I finished the book at about 8:30 that evening in that coffee shop. I literally could not stand up. And I rang Paul and I just said, you know the way people say I read it in one sitting? Well, generally that one sitting is going to be at home. I was about 3 hours from home and I really needed to get home, but I could not. It was like, I'll read one more chapter. And I have an impression of the culture of Leicester Tigers from that book. And I felt it was, it delivered a fair amount of success during that era, the Martin Johnson era, the Graham Rowntree, all those guys, Lewis Moody, Matt Lewis. But I thought it was an incredibly unhealthy climate, a really destructive culture. And I think it worked against Leinster. When modernity came, they weren't able to change quickly enough. And their old kind of hard fighting on the bus, you know, that kind of old school stuff, it didn't translate well into the modern era, and they have struggled, you know, with the rise of Saracens and Exeter Chiefs. Leicester have gone down. But that book told that story. It told the story of the rise and the fall of Leicester Tigers. It told the story of Matt Hampson's appalling injury. And I mean, one story that I would tell over and over again from that book. I just love when the story where Paul brings a manuscript of the book, or a version of the book to Matt, and Matt reads it. And Paul says, "What do you think?" And Matt says, "Yeah, you know, I really liked it." And Paul, and people who know Paul would understand this. Paul said to him, no, that's not what you really think. And Matt said, no, I did like it. No, you fucker, you didn't. There's something you didn't like about the book. And Matt said, no, I really liked it. And Paul said, I can see it. Is it your mum? You know, you didn't want your mum to know that you were cheating on your girlfriend at the time of the accident. No. Mum knows about that. It's cool. It was your girlfriend. You didn't want her. You don't like it in the book that you've admitted this. And Matt said, it's not that. And Paul says, well, what is it? Because I know there's something. And Matt Hampson, who's now paralyzed from the neck down, says to Paul, you know where you describe the girl I brought back to the hotel on the Saturday night after the game in Dublin, like 4 days before he's going to have this appalling accident. It's the last time he's going to make love to anybody. He said, you know the way you described sex, the way I kind of pulled her shirt off in a really like mad, passionate way? And Paul said, yeah. And Matt said, you actually made the sex sound a lot better than it was.
Wow.
And I just thought, I mean, Matt Hampson, what a man, you know?
Wow.
He said, you made the sex out to be better than it was.
But it's also, that's the best review. That's the best book review I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, that book is full of that kind of lovely insight. And it was just Paul did a terrific job. And I mean, we could be here all day talking about the great pieces Paul Kimmage has done. I mean, his recent piece on Jack Charlton, I absolutely loved. And the Rory McIlroy stuff, you know, but I go back to you and say, the piece Paul wrote about the death of Thierry Claviola, his former teammate, when Paul was a pro cyclist, that piece I thought was a haunting piece and a quite brilliant piece. But, you know, he leaves behind a body of work that will stand the test of time and people will look back upon it. And I mean, I was doing a piece recently, a column where David Hickey came into the column, the former Dublin footballer. And I just went back and read the interview that Paul did with him. Easily the best interview. I know there's a recent interview with David Hickey, which was excellent as well. And forgive me, I don't remember the journalist, but it was a hell of a piece. But Paul's piece way back with David Hickey a few years ago was terrific as well. So Engage is just one of the great things that Paul has done. And it's kind of, it's my favorite because I just, you know, the way they say, can you remember where you were when Kennedy was killed? I can't. Can you remember where you were on such and such a day, 9/11? I can't. Can you remember where you were when you read Engage? I definitely can't.
Paul went on News Talk 4 years ago and said that the relationship between you guys was dead and it was finished over. He took objection at your coverage of Team Sky. Is the relationship dead?
No, it's not dead. No. I mean, or if could I quote Mark Twain?
Yes.
Reports of the death of our relationship have been greatly exaggerated.
Oh, very good.
No, we talk I've seen Paul a number of times over the last, maybe when I say a number of times, 3 or 4 times over the last couple of years. We've spent time in each other's company. I mean, I live in England, he lives in Dublin, so it's not easy. We speak on the phone pretty regularly. I would, you know, it would be amazing if, you know, if I didn't speak to him, so we're saying every couple of weeks. Now, there would have been a time when we would have spoken, you know, twice every day. So
yeah.
It's not quite where it was, but I think it's pretty good. I would still regard him as a close friend. And I always regarded him as a close friend, even when Paul didn't feel that he wanted to be, that he didn't want our relationship to endure. But I think Paul, I hope he wouldn't mind me saying it, there are times when he gets very angry and very annoyed at something. And I used to say to him during those times, you know, when we would talk about stuff like that, I'd say, you're never at your most rational when you're at your most angry. They don't go hand in hand. And I think Paul would probably admit that. I don't know if he would, but I think it's true. And I have got many, many faults and many things that are not great about me. And, he'd be certainly entitled to say that. But my argument always was to him, there's too much shared history between us for us not to talk to each other. That would be ridiculous. I mean, we go back to Ross Taunton, 1980 or 1981, whenever Paul met Anne, his wife. I mean, I knew Anne before Paul knew her. And we kind of got to know each other. He got to know Anne partly as a result of kind of I taking Anne and the Ross Taunton. And she came in the car because her brother was riding in the race, Paul Nolan. And she came, she wanted to lift. Her dad asked me, would I take her? And I did. And I think it was that Sunday that Anne met Paul in the Phoenix Park at the end of the Ross Taunton. And, you know, the amount of times we've spent together. I mean, Molly, our youngest daughter, was talking yesterday about being on the beach in Portugal, and the Kimmages and the Welches were there together. And our kids played with their kids when they went out to the nightclub at night. You know, Owen and Evelyn and Luke went out with Molly and Emily and Connor, whoever was around, and they all went out together. We spent, you know, endless days on that beach at Valdelobo together. So, you know, how can you just say all of that didn't happen? Mm. I couldn't, and I don't think Paul can either, because you know, he picks up the phone when I answer, and we have good chats.
Oh well, I'm glad to hear it. Next time you're telling him, or you're talking to him, do tell him to come on this show. We've been asking a couple of times, but
yes, yeah.
We'll get him eventually. On the Team Sky stuff, I mean, you got a bit of criticism for it. I think it's fair to say Paul vocalized it. I'll give the context for listeners in case you don't know. So, you did a book with Team Sky. You spent 13 weeks within the camp, and Paul took objection to a piece that you wrote in the Sunday Times, and then with the book itself, it emerged in the press that Bradley Wiggins had been given 3 TUEs. It didn't break the rules, but as a parliamentary select committee found, they did cross an ethical line, mainly because these were pretty powerful TUEs and they were administered just weeks before a couple of the Tour de France and I think a Giro d'Italia as well. And Paul, like, specifically said, in terms of the specific criticisms of you, just to contextualize that for listeners, the fact that you failed to disclose the fact that Paul was also given the same access and then it was reneged upon at the last minute, and then you quoted Bradley Wiggins, or sorry, told a story of Bradley Wiggins telling someone around him to snap off a Livestrong ban because, you know, Lance Armstrong is persona non grata here, whereas in Wiggins he'd put in his book that he admired Armstrong in various ways. So, like, how do you look back at it now? Was the criticism difficult? Was it fair? How do you reflect on it?
I think it was fair. I had no difficulty with it. Now, it should be said, you make the point about that the Bradley Wiggins' TUEs, which was cheating. Absolutely, no question. That emerged in September 2016. Mm. I had spent time inside Team Sky in 2013. So there's a 3-year gap. So now you could say you went embedded, but you never found out about the TUEs. That's absolutely true. I didn't. And what you learn from being embedded is that the fact that you're embedded doesn't guarantee that you're going to be told everything. And you don't really have the right to break into the doctor's room and maybe open up files and photograph them or steal stuff. I mean, I wasn't going to do that. I thought at the time I was seduced really by Brailsford with the offer of being inside the team. Being inside the team was a really interesting experience, but unfulfilling journalistically. Now, when I say that, I say it kind of, you know, reservedly, because when I was inside the team, I made contacts. And when stories broke later, I was in a better position to write them than most people because I knew lots of people in the team. I mean, they had a writer who tested positive, and in 2015 or 2014 World Championships, Sunday Times were the newspaper that broke the story. Like, we broke that this guy was positive. Now, it turned out that he'd actually been positive from his previous team, but it was when he joined Sky that the results came out. And if I were to go back and had the chance to make a new decision, I wouldn't go in Team Sky. It was Frankie Andreo said something to me that I disagreed vehemently with him at the time. Frankie said, look, stay on the outside and stay neutral. And I said, Frankie, but if I believe Team Sky are clean, and I deliberately stopped myself saying that, is that not a lie? But my mistake really was to presume that they would never have done what they did in relation to those Wigan's TUEs. I didn't think that was part of what Brailsford would do. And I kind of jumped to the conclusion that he had more integrity than he had. I think that was a shocking decision to give Wiggins those TUEs. Richard Freeman, the doctor, is still before the General Medical Council in the UK. His case is coming up in the autumn. And hopefully, you know, that will be resolved, that case. And I think it completely, not tarnishes, but it kind of takes all the credibility from Wiggins's Tour de France victory. I don't regard him as a legitimate winner of the Tour. I think at the very least there should be an asterisk there highlighting the fact that he used TUEs that, in my opinion, he never needed. Now, when the story broke, I was in a position to write well about it because I had real insight into the team. I totally believe that Brailsford should have been sacked, or he should have resigned once it came out. That didn't happen. And it meant that I was never going to speak to Brailsford again, and not in any kind of affable way, that's for sure. And I haven't spoken to him since. And I go on the Tour de France, and I try to do my job. Part of that job should be listening to, I mean, if this is a press conference, I will go in and listen, but I don't want to interact with him because ultimately, he said to me, look, we do things correctly. You can come inside our team and you can look wherever you like and you will see that we're doing nothing untoward. And you might say naively, I believe that. And I went in and of course I didn't know anything about these TUEs. I mean, the third TUE happened at a time when I was inside the team. But the doctors who were doing it, some of whom I was quite good friends with, they were never going to tell me, we've just given Brad a new TUE. I mean, Richard Freeman, I interviewed him, and he was quite bland, and I interviewed him during that tour of Italy. And he said to me, I don't trust anybody in this sport. Now, the reality was that he was about the least trustworthy of any doctor in the Tour de France, because he was the one who organized these TUEs for Bradley Wiggins. And he's the one who's now, you know, facing charges from the General Medical Council of having ordered testosterone patches. Now, this is going to sound like I'm trying to kind of justify my existence. Richard Freeman is before the Medical Council because he ordered testosterone patches that were delivered to Team Sky in the headquarters of British Cycling. That story appeared for the first time in the Sunday Times, and I wrote it. Mm. So I can't deny, you know, that even though it might have been the wrong decision, journalistically, I got a lot out of it. And whether I like it or not, that's the truth. And so, I don't mind saying it was a bad decision on my behalf. The Armstrong thing had just happened. Maybe there was a bit of, you know, that very dangerous feeling of, you know, that you can almost do anything and it'll be right because you're on a bit of a crest of a wave. Maybe I was influenced by that. I would think possibly, you know, if somebody said, I think you got carried away, I'd say, I didn't feel like I got carried away, but maybe I did. So, yeah. You know, I mean, and as I say, if you gave me the chance to do it again, I certainly would say, no, Dave, I'm staying on the outside, safer place.
Yeah. So I was going to ask how or if it has changed you, but obviously that's how you wouldn't. You're not going to accept an invite into the tent.
No, because I would say to any journalist, be careful being embedded. You know, but maybe I should have known that, because if you'd said to me, what do you think about those foreign correspondents who go, war correspondents who go embedded with the US Army when they're invading Iraq? I say, well, they're only going to be shown what the US Army wants them to see. So journalistically, it's pretty hopeless. And somebody then might have said to me, but you went into Team Sky and they were only going to show you what they wanted you to see. And I would have then been stuck for an answer. But you know, and that is the limitation of being embedded. The people who are inviting you in are inviting you in on their terms. And now, again, it's life is never simple. In some respects, it is simple. In many respects, it's not. Some of the best people that I met in sport, in terms of background people, they were in Team Sky, really honourable, decent people. And the remarkable thing about Brailsford was that although his behaviour in relation to those TUEs was completely unacceptable and he should have been sacked for it in my eyes, I certainly wanted him sacked. I wrote a column in the Sunday Times saying he should be sacked. He actually is a brilliant manager. He's extremely clever. He's a really good judge of people in terms of bringing people in who'll work, who'll contribute to the dynamic. The reason why this year's Tour de France is fascinating is because Brailsford has three team leaders. The best known of them is Chris Froome. Probably the most talented of them now is Egan Bernal, who won last year's race. Brailsford doesn't really want Froome in the team this year, in my eyes, because Froome could be far more trouble than he's worth. But he's a four-time winner of the race in Team Sky's colours. So Brailsford can't really keep him out of the team. That would be considered outrageously cruel and unfair to the race. How can you keep a great champion out of your team? Well, the first week of the race has a lot of mountain passes. If Egan Bernal establishes himself as the best of Team Sky's, Team Ineos's three leaders, from Chris Froome, Egan Bernal, Geraint Thomas, they're the guys who won the last three tours. Brailsford has all of them in his team. He has a serious rival in other teams. There's one team this year that really could put them under pressure, and they've got some really good riders. But if Froome is not the main man at the end of the first week, he could be incredibly difficult within the team in terms of he being unable to accept, because he won't easily accept that he's not the main man, even if he's not the main man.
Yeah.
And that makes management of the team really difficult, and it creates an incredibly sour atmosphere when everybody's going to be stressed. So for that reason, I thought it's potentially a fascinating tour.
Yeah. Now, look, I'm saying this from my perspective as a hurler on a ditch, but you mentioned something about it would disrespect the tour to dump Chris Froome off the team. Is the history of the Tour de France in the last 25 years not been people disrespecting the tour?
Yeah. In terms of people doping, yes, it has. But at the same time, you know, the people who love the sport, it's not that they don't realise that doping has been a big part of it. They do. But it's like maybe it's become a guilty pleasure for them.
Yeah.
But a lot of people love the race. And if you said to them, but there's been dopers who won, yes, there has. But has that stopped them loving it? Some people have stopped loving it. But also some people have started loving it. But the thing is, it hasn't become a race that nobody is bothered about anymore. Some people will say, well, I can't enjoy it because I don't know what I'm watching. I get that, and that's fine. When that race starts, this week in when it starts, it's meant to start the 29th of August. But when the race is that first week, I don't know if I'm covering it yet. It has to be decided because I would like to cover it because I think it'll be a really interesting kind of situation within Team Ineos with their three leaders. But I know if I was sitting at home and I knew that this was the Monday, first Monday of the tour, and there was a pretty tough mountain at the end of today's stage, I'd be sitting in front of my TV, unable to look away. I would have to watch it. And you might say, but come on, you've seen so much doping. Yes, I have, but it doesn't stop me wanting to watch the race.
Yeah, that amazes me. I would have assumed that, you know, we have tested and tasted too much liver. Like, you have seen too much at this point.
Yeah, but you see, but on the other hand, Gavin, if you said to me, David, remember this guy, first Colombian to win last year, do you believe he's clean? I'd say, I don't know. But and then you might say, this is my favorite trick with people who sit on the fence. I say, okay, I'm holding a gun to your head, right? There's a bullet in it. If you get the answer wrong, I'm pulling the trigger and you're dead. Did the guy cheat to win last year's Tour de France? Yes or no? And now my life depends on it, about Bernal. I'm not sure, but yeah. I have to give a certain answer. I'm saying he was clean. And I may be dead like 2 seconds later, or I may not be. But if you put the gun to my head and force me to offer an opinion on something I would rather not offer an opinion on, I would say clean.
Yeah. Is that the fan in you wanting him to be clean, or is it the journalist in you that knows I'm getting sued to high heaven if I can't prove it?
No. Nothing to do with being sued. Nothing to do. And maybe there's an element of I just watch the way he rides, and I think he's the classiest cyclist we've seen since Greg LeMond. And Greg LeMond, remember, was 30 years ago, 35 years ago when he won his first tour, 34 years ago when he won his first tour. But this is the classiest guy we've seen since then. See, and I don't mean you, like, but people don't realize that when EPO came into the peloton, Colombian cycling disappeared because all the Colombians were natural climbers. They were brilliant. The best Colombians were kind of the angel of the mountains guys who could produce great performances going up a mountain, but didn't really have the physical robustness. They weren't big enough. Their small stature made them brilliant in the mountains. But they struggled then with the entirety of a three-week race. EPO comes along, and all the big guys, like Miguel Indurain, they can suddenly now have as much oxygen as they want, and they can go up the mountains. And Colombian cycling disappeared during the EPO years. Their natural advantage was taken away. If everybody can go up the mountains like a Colombian, and all these guys are much bigger men than the Colombians, they've got bigger engines. So when they get on the flat roads, they're dominant. So Colombian guys disappeared. Egan Bernal is a neatly built kind of athlete, but he's still typically Colombian in that he's slight. But he climbs. I mean, the guy lives at 8,000 feet, right, in Colombia. And I remember in that press conference of last year's tour, somebody said, but you know, it is an advantage, you know, to live at 8,000 feet. And he's kind of saying, you know, don't just see me like that. You've got to see me as a guy who can ride his bike really well. But by the way, I live at 8,000 feet, but I train at 11,000. So if you've grown up training at 11,000 feet all your life, it's going to cause an evolution in your physiology that's going to make you a bloody good mountain climber. So he should be doing well, and he should be a classy rider in the mountains, and he is. And if you said to me, but do you not think he's got a doping system behind him? I would say to you, just offer me some evidence on that. Just try to come up with something. Find an Emma O'Reilly, find a Betsy Andreo, find somebody who was in a room with him when he admitted something. Just one scintilla of evidence. And give us something that we can get our teeth into, go and chase.
Yeah. Would you still have the appetite to do that that you did with Lance however many years ago?
I think I'd have the appetite, but I mightn't have the energy. You know, one of the things about life, I've always believed, is that if you're a guy who hitches his system to enthusiasm, and I would have always seen myself like that. If you'd said to me, you know, if you were my boss and we were having a performance review, and you said to me, David, what do you see as your qualities as a journalist? I'd say, I've only got one. I'm enthusiastic. You know, I like the job. I always wanted to do it. And I've got a lot of enthusiasm. But for me, the enthusiasm, it exists in a well. And you go to the well with the bucket and you take out a bucket full every week if you're writing for a Sunday newspaper. And even though the well replenishes itself, it never replenishes itself at the rate you take it out from. Mm. So the older you get, the less enthusiastic you are. I think I'm still enthusiastic, but am I the same guy that I was 30 years ago? Absolutely not. 20 years ago, definitely not. So, I mean, crazily, really. And I don't know if the Times will send me, because I think we may be restricted to one journalist, and Matt Dickinson, a colleague of mine, would want to go and cover the tour as well. He's chief sports writer of the Times. I'm Sunday Times because I work for just the Sunday. It makes me less useful in a way. It's more of a luxury to send a Sunday guy on the tour. But I would still like to go. But if I am not sent, there won't be any toys coming out of the pram, because I'm not the guy I was 30 years ago.
Yeah. Look, we're in fairness, your enthusiasm for this podcast is very admirable. It's the longest one we've done. So we're going to turn for home with a couple of quick fire questions. A couple of them come in, David, from our listeners in our WhatsApp group. Gar asks, it seems that some sports, so athletics, cycling, swimming, etc., are widely considered to be corrupted by drugs, whereas others like soccer, tennis and motorsports are not. Does David think that this is a reflection of each sport's testing efficacy or willingness, or of the true level of drug use in each sport?
Yeah, I mean, if you said to me, is there more doping in football than we think? I would say yes. I don't think the football authorities are really out there trying to catch people. I think the football authorities are out there trying to make it look like they have an anti-doping program, and they want to discourage doping, but they don't want to discover doping. I think the same is true of rugby. I think rugby wants to discourage doping. They'd prefer if it didn't exist, but they don't want to find it. And we're into this awful situation, and Paul Kimmage has written about this a lot, and it's the medicalization of sport. It's the use of painkillers and anti-inflammatories and drugs that really were never meant to get injured players onto the pitch. And that's not a good thing. And I think, especially in rugby, we're going to discover at some point in the future the true cost of concussion. I think that's a story waiting to be written. But it's like, you know, this generation of players has to get old, and they will get old. And I think we may discover that all those knocks to the head had more of an influence than we ever thought. You look at Claire Astell, Jeff Astell's daughter, what she's done about head injury, and it's absolutely admirable. I would love to have spent more time fighting that cause, because it's a good one. You know, should kids be heading a football? You know, young kids with kind of fragile skulls, definitely not. You know, it just shouldn't be happening. I mean, I watched that, was it Chelsea Man United the other day, where we saw some really bad head injuries?
Oh yeah, Eric Bailly, yeah.
Eric Bailly, and and I mean, just with Wan-Bissaka in one case and another one with the Chelsea player, really kind of, you think, oh God, horrible. And but back to the question on doping, yes, there's more doping in the bigger sports. See, you have this fear that sports like football and all the money, it's like they're too big to have a problem. You know, there's too much riding on the image of football as a wholesome sport for anybody to ever go in there and say, you know what, there is a problem. I'm not sure there's a problem. I'm not sure there's a significant problem. But I'd say, are people doing things and getting away with it? Yes.
Yeah. Question from Ronan Folan. David, I've read your stuff for years and you're great. Some stuff on drugs in sport, not just cycling, would be interesting, but obviously it's not all that David does. So I'd be interested in how does that square with him? Is it a bit like a TV soap star gets typecast in a role? You've been successful investigating and publishing drug stories, but it's not all you do. So does it bother you that that's largely what you're associated with?
I think that's a very generous comment about what I've been doing with my life. No, it doesn't really bother me. You know what? You know what? I came across, God, I've forgotten the guy now, some great, he was a singer or an actor or something. And he said, you know, what pleased him at the end of his life was that he was able to make a book doing what he did. And I've been a sports writer, really. I mean, in The Observer, I was a general guy in the Leitrim Observer. But I've been doing this job since 1978. And that's 42 years. And every week for those 42 years, I've been paid to write about sport. Now, if there's any achievement in my career, that's it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I look at all the guys who get made redundant, and I say to everybody in my family, you know, sometimes they worry about, we're going to have some big redundancies in the Times and the Sunday Times in the next 2 months. We've been told that. Nobody knows who it is. But there's one thing sure, that, you know, ultimately there's a bullet there for everybody. And the person who thinks there isn't a bullet for him is an idiot, in my view. And if it happens to me, I guarantee you, Gavin, and hold me to this, I won't be complaining. I won't be saying, I don't know if you saw Clive Tilsey's, the ITV commentator, moaning about ITV letting him go. Alan Green did it in the Times in an interview with Henry Winter. Now, I know Alan Green well, and I like Alan Green. And I thought, Alan, don't. You had a good innings. You had a good run. Everybody's got a shelf life. You know, your view is that you could go on doing it and you were good enough. I totally respect your right to that view. Now, you respect the right of the guy to say, you know what, your time is up. We have a younger guy who we think we can make better than you are now. That's life. And I just think, Tilsey this week, our youngest boy Connor is in Germany now. He's got a German partner living in Berlin, and he sent me a text and said, Dad, can you believe Clive Tilsey? And I wrote back and said, no, Connor, I can't. And Connor said, yeah. You know,
these last three questions we ask everyone, David, and they get increasingly difficult as they go along, I'm afraid. Who's the most interesting person you've met through work?
Oh, God.
I recognize that sigh.
Yeah. When I was, I mean, and it is privileged, because I'm going to tell you now, yesterday evening, I did an interview with Mauro Itoje in London, and we met in a restaurant, and we had a bite, you know, a little bit bowl of soup, and then we started talking. And we talked away for 3 hours, right? A kind of really interesting conversation with a really interesting man, for sure. And it is a kind of a privileged life I've had. But the only time in my journalistic life where I felt hairs growing on the back of my head, you know, literally standing up, and I think, I'm always going to remember this, and I have, was I did a story for the Sunday Independent about Leitrim winning the Connacht Championship. I'm probably going to get the date wrong. I think it was 1995 or 96, but I was working.
94, I think it was.
I went there about a week later, or that following week afterwards, and I interviewed Seamus O'Rourke, who at the time was a cabinet maker in Carrigallen. And Seamus O'Rourke was telling me about his life as a young Leitrim footballer. And Seamus O'Rourke was an extraordinarily gifted young footballer. I mean, he's now a great storyteller and performer, and I really enjoy anything he puts on video. I find interesting. But Seamus told about how he was the star of every team he ever played on, until he played for Leitrim in the Father Manning Cup, which is under 16, I think.
Yeah.
Sligo, Roscommon, Leitrim, and maybe Fermanagh. Or Westmeath instead of Fermanagh. And Leitrim then lost 4 games in a row. And it seemed to Seamus that was the first time he'd ever lost in his life, because he was always single-handedly able to win. And he goes home to his father and he says, I can't believe we're just losing every time now. And his father said to him, son, you're losing because you're playing for Leitrim. You know, as in, get used to it. And Seamus became a bit disillusioned, went off to New York, didn't really commit to the football life, to discipline. But now Leitrim had won. And he's in with his friends. They go over the border into Cavan, Black Lion. That's where they want to celebrate on the Sunday night. They want the Cavan, basically the Cavan bastards who'd looked down on them for years because they were Leitrim. They wanted them to see them celebrate. And they have this brilliant sing-song in a pub in Black Lion. Fantastic sing-song.
Yeah,
and everybody is up really high. And a friend of Seamus's has made this interview happen for me, and we're there. And then the friend says to Seamus, and then at the end of the night, you told your poem, you recited your poem. And Seamus says, yeah. And the friend said, Seamus, tell David, recite the poem for David. And Seamus O'Rourke recited his poem. And that was the journalistic moment of my life in terms of this. I was transfixed. Mm. I mean, Seamus O'Rourke's poem was one he'd made up in his head, basically, because he'd struggled in school. He didn't really write as such. And the poem he made up was about his townsland in outside Ballinamore or outside Carrigallen in Leitrim. And it was basically the Drumainchin Hills. And I'll just give you the first three lines of it, or four lines. Something like, Seamus started up, this is now a pub full of Leitrim people, all his friends. And he starts off, and they've never heard this poem. Lie down flat, you Drumainchin Hills, for there's damn all for you to see. And there's no one looks at your rushy sides or your mossy bottom down at Kelly's Drain. And what sod you have can go to sleep. No, and what sod you have can go to sleep. For hungry sheep would rather wait to die. And I just thought, and the poem went on and told the story of love of homeland in a way that you've never heard it. You know, there's a verse in it which is like maudlin sentimentality. And I'll sit beside you now and sing songs of times gone by when young men made hay with a fork and drank tay from a bottle and hid their joy in your drawky camouflage. And you think, lovely. And then it goes back to the unsheltered fields and cattle walking knee-deep in the daub and the mud and backs bent lifting watery spuds. And I just thought, that's the thing about home. It doesn't matter if it's perfect or if it's good or if it's bad. It's home. It's everything. And once Seamus recited his poem that night, there were tears in lots of people's eyes, and everybody just went quiet and went home.
Wow.
It was the perfect climax. It was sad and it was beautiful and it was real. Now, I know that's not what people want to hear, maybe, you know, your heroes, whatever. But that to me was the greatest moment. Just thought, wow, what a talent. And what a way of describing your love of homeland.
I think that piece is in the Sunday Indo anthology that they brought out a couple of years ago. Because I think I've read it. And that must be where I've read it. It's the most interesting place you've been with work, I mean to ask.
The most interesting place I've been as a journalist was Bismarck Duplessis' farm in the Orange Free State in South Africa. After the first test in the Lions, which South Africa won, must have been, or maybe it was before the first test. Well, anyway, I approached Bismarck Duplessis through the South African media guy and said, any chance of getting an interview? And Bismarck looked at me and said, I can't do it now, but he said, I'm going home to the farm for the weekend, and if you want to drive up to the farm, I'll give you plenty of time up there. And I go up to the farm on a Saturday afternoon, and I basically met Bismarck, did the interview, met his family, stayed Saturday night, had Sunday lunch, and I mean, the lunch that those people put on, and they were really modest, down-to-earth farmers, you know, who had worked in that area. I mean, I was just blown away by the entire experience. I met his dad. I met his mum, who was the most amazing mum, sporting mum I've ever met. I mean, this was a mum, right, who said to the boys, I don't care how good you are at rugby, you've got to have proper jobs. And they said, but mum, rugby is a job. And they said, no, no, rugby's not a job. Because if you consider rugby's a job, rugby will leave you on the scrap heap when you're 31 or 32. And what are you going to do then if you've got no training? You're going to go back to university and do something? She said, you won't. So you do the university before you become a professional rugby player. And Bismarck did a business degree, you know, did extremely well at the University of Bloemfontein. Yanni did a medical degree. And last story I'll tell you that Bismarck's mother told me. She said, Yanni got an offer to join the Gauteng Lions in Johannesburg and play for them, a contract. And they were offering decent money, but he would have to give up his medical degree after 3 years. And he rings up his mum and he said, Mum, they've offered me a fantastic contract, but I'm just going to kind of suspend my medical degree and go up to Johannesburg and play for them. And she said, Yanni, I'll speak with your dad and ring me tomorrow. And Yanni rings her tomorrow. And she said, I've just had a brief chat with your dad. And what I've got here, Yanni, is the ledger that I always kept about how much money it cost us to send you to boarding school at Grey College, about how much money we've put into your university degree. And it comes to the equivalent of about 300,000 euros, all the money they'd put in, something really expensive. And she said, you tell the head coach of the Gauteng Lions, he can have you when he pays me what I'm owed. Right? And Yanni rings her back. Yanni says to her, he says, Mum, let me think about this and I'll call you tomorrow. And Yanni calls the next day. And he said, Mum, I've thought about it. I think I'll finish my medical degree. You know, he came to London to play the Crusaders. He was playing for the Natal Sharks, right? He came to London to play a game. They flew out on a Wednesday afternoon about 2 o'clock. And he played on the Saturday. It was a game to raise money for the earthquake victims and reconstruction of Christchurch. And they played the game at Twickenham. Yanni did 5 operations that morning before getting on the flight. 5 operations. Yeah. Surgeries. Because he's now an orthopedic, I think, surgeon.
Yeah.
I just thought that was, Jo Helene was the mum's name, and that was her achievement. Those two boys, you know, Yanni is playing for Bismarck is playing for Montpellier now, and he's running the family farm virtually from Montpellier. You know, conference call first thing every morning with the farm manager, go through the day. Everything he has on his phone, satellite, he can see every acre of all the crops that are growing. He can zoom in. He showed me all this stuff. He can know if the irrigation is not working in such and such a field, and he can see how everything is progressing. Yeah. Just like, you know, extraordinary. But that week in the farm introduced me to the family, and I thought easily the most interesting sporting family I've ever met.
Definitely. Mothers know best. I think it's one of the irrevocable rules of life. Our last question, David, this is an admittedly unfair question. If you had written one of the three pieces you submitted to us, so it's Paul Kimmage's book, Engage, Damian Recio's story on Lance Armstrong from 2005, or the William Knack piece on Bobby Fischer, if you had written one of those pieces, which one would it be?
It would have to be, and I'm not saying this because Paul's my friend, it would have to be Engage, because Engage was just a book. I mean, I've written some kind of half-decent articles, and I wouldn't say I've written any books worthy of the name, really, but it's easier to do a brilliant 3,000-word piece than it is to do a brilliant 100,000-word piece. Yeah. And that's why the book would have to take precedence. Now, the Damian Recio piece was just a delight because it was so clever. It's like catching the crooks with a trick so fantastic that you literally couldn't make it up unless you were Damian Recio.
Yeah.
And I would advise everybody else actually to go and find that William Knack piece. You've read it. You know what it's like. It's a terrific piece of writing.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. We'll share it. David, your new book is The Russian Affair, the true story of the couple who discovered the greatest sporting scandal. It is out now. Thank you so much for doing the show. You've been generous with your time and your thoughts, so we're really very grateful.
It's been a pleasure, Gavin. Honestly, it has.
Thank you very much to David. And thanks to you for listening to and supporting this show and for supporting the 42 as a whole. We all really do greatly appreciate it. And trust me, nobody appreciates it more than I do, as I got to do that conversation, which I really greatly enjoyed. We're going to be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.